and welcome to Wrestling and Everything Coast to Coast with your host. This time it's just us, wrestling's premier photographer, Dr. Mike Leno, and Buddy Sotelo Esquire. It's we've got a short show too. We got the 4th of July holiday coming on us, but we want to take the week off, especially since unfortunately we have more sad news to report as far as a wrestler death is concerned, something that about 75% of our shows are dedicated to. And this week we lost Draws. What was his first name? Drozdov?
Darren. Yeah, Darren. Darren nicknamed Draws or Puke.
Right.
And I was trying to find a few photos of him, and I shot him at only three events, live events that they had, house shows, and one was a dark match. And I guess the big takeaway is how beloved he was. This was a former football NFL player, played for the Broncos, the Eagles, the Jets, New York Jets in the NFL. And his death was also covered all over the NFL's website. He was only 54, so he died on the 30th of June. He was only 54, even though they said the family released it as a natural causes. And he passed away, let's see, I guess that was Thursday morning and or Friday morning. And it says, no words to convey the deep loss of loss and sadness we are feeling right now. So this is what the family wrote and put out there. Draws maintained a championship mindset and lived every day to the fullest. So we'll read that, come back to that. But he was in a match, just a freak accident, one of those things that shows you that pro wrestling can be dangerous, the bumps and stuff can be dangerous, was paralyzed. Let me read that part. You know, and they at least did the in memorial graphic to him on Friday Night SmackDown last Friday. He was from New Jersey. He became a wrestler. He got done with his training in 1997. A year later, signed to WWE deal. So I'm pretty sure he was at Florida Championship Wrestling. And given the name Puke, I think Vince came up with that because he could vomit on demand. You know, they had that thing in Beyond the Mat, that scene where Vince asked him to puke. He pukes in a trash can. So he could just do it on command, which not a lot of people can do. It's like crying for an actor on command. It's, you know, difficult.
It's a lot worse to be able to throw up on command, because that doesn't do good things to your body. You can cry and you're not going to, you know, rip out your esophagus, but you throw up too many times and you will.
I can only remember him, so I'm reading this from the family's website. He's part of the Legion of Doom, which was what the Road Warriors, Hawk and Animal, were called in WWF in the 90s, not E. And he was kind of put in to a more prominent spot with Animal when Hawk was having health and substance issues. And, you know, then he got the name Draws, short for his last name, Drozdov, spelled Drozdov. And his career ended, though. So it was a very short wrestling career. He was on an episode of SmackDown for the tapings, October of 1999. He was D'Lo Brown, who's, you know, I'm sure he's always maintained a friendship with him. And D'Lo is a really super duper guy. Ethically, he felt bad, but he was doing a running power bomb and it just ended badly. He landed on his neck, fractured two vertebrae in his neck. And after several hours of surgeries, he was a quadriplegic with no movement below his neck. He was able to regain movement in his upper body and arms, but was still stuck in a wheelchair for the rest of his life. But we do have to throw props to WWE, which we don't always do. They kept him on the payroll for ever since. To my knowledge, he was kept on the payroll till he passed. He did all kinds of things as a goodwill ambassador. He wrote for their website, and as well as the WWE magazines before they folded those. A regular guest on the Bite This show that's on Peacock, I believe. But a super duper guy. All of the talent loved him. From Degeneration X to all of the women.
He was never really bitter. He was never really bitter to the WWF or with wrestling for, you know, being what caused him to be in that state or that condition. As far as I remember, he was the first wrestler that I can recall being severely, severely injured in the ring. I'm sure, obviously, that's happened before, but, you know, and the Bruno Sammartino had his neck broken, but he was able to get back in the ring. You know,
well, there was the jobber that was in the match with the Rockers, and I forget it. I think it was Jannetty. I'm not sure if it was Michaels or Jannetty, but I'm just doing this from memory. People can look it up. And he was just a job enhancement talent guy, and he was also left a quadriplegic, and the family sued and all of that stuff. But not in this case. This guy loved the biz. He grew up as a fan, which you love seeing. You love hearing all these NFL players of all denominations that grew up loving Ric Flair and, you know, on the other side, Hulk Hogan. But the ones especially hit us or me hard are the ones that love Ric Flair since they're little kids. That's impressive. And, you know, them doing the woo chants and all of that stuff to pay tribute to him. But again, this is a super nice guy. He's a really nice guy. The one time I got to yak with him backstage when he was still a wrestler. And yeah, he was not bitter as many could be. And I paused. I'm having to watch, you know, see if I have any photos in the Medusa Trish Treasures episode. But you want to see somebody that can give WWE a kick in the balls when they just come calling and want stuff donated to it's basically their warehouse. So I'll get back to draws, but Medusa, you really have to watch what a savvy business person she is in not just giving the belt. You know, she already offered it at the 2015 Hall of Fame. I was with her there backstage, even with our joint friend, Fumi Saito, who was my boss at Weekly Pro Magazine until he retired, but he had a lot more influence in Medusa's career in All Japan Women. But yeah, they just normally, you know, they just think of people are going to give these artifacts back.
Well, yeah, let's give a little bit of background. There's that WWE, you're talking about the WWE Treasures program, the Treasure Hunters
program. Right. They have, this is a new season, so they have Lita and Mick Foley. They're involving Trish a little bit to get.
But for people who don't know, they get wrestlers, ex-wrestlers, to go around the country and try to buy, either bid for it or just flat out, you know, ask for donations for people who have certain memorabilia of certain wrestlers per episode. So they go around looking for Andre the Giant stuff, or they go around looking for a Bruno Sammartino stuff.
Well, in this case, they wanted Medusa's pink belt that she dropped in the trash that first Nitro. But the thing is, and I have some input here of my own, is that a lot of that stuff goes in that hangar. There might be several, the storage units in Stamford, and they're like airplane hangars, and they may trot that material out because they have no physical Hall of Fame.
Is the problem. Giving it and selling it back to Vince just means that it's going to wind up going nowhere.
Well, it's collecting dust. A lot of the video and stuff collecting dust. But they came to me when my editor Pro Wrestling Illustrated magazine, my photo editor, and he was a pretty big guy there, then got hired at WWE. Like the first year, he offered me low six figures for all of my slides, negatives, the stuff that I'd shot, you know, since the early 70s, pretty much everything all over the world, lots of Japanese and Canadian and Mexico and Europe tours of wrestling events. And, you know, I declined because I could never use those again. But in this case, you know, you also have to have respect. So Mick Foley goes to her house in Orlando and asks for the belt that she offered to give Vince free in 2015 at our San Jose Santa Clara. But it was at the San Jose Shark Tank where the San Jose Sharks play. And I was backstage. I wasn't there for her meeting Vince, you know, or seeing him again after all of those years. When they fired her, they fired her and let her keep that belt. And that belt is, well, they put a value of 40 to 50 grand on it, on the graphics on TV, but she knows that that belt was worth a lot and asked Mick, I'm not surprising anybody here, with 100 grand to either loan it or just buy it outright. She said the price is the same either way. If you watch the episode, as must see, because of how savvy she is. And I've only gotten through half of it. So when I leave in about 20, I'll finish up. But I think that might be it. And they're just going for Johnny Mae Young stuff, trying to get the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame in Albany, New York, to just cough up Mae Young's robe or sequin robe and her crown that she wore in a lot of Woody Farmer shows and those, you know, his TV tapings, where a lot of APW, our brothers and sisters, wrestled. But Mike Lockwood, Aaron O'Grady, was somebody that Mae Young worked with. I don't know if you know that story, Russ. Tell me how much you know, because Mae Young, Johnny Mae Young, and that was how Moolah Lillian always called her, so we always called her that. But she was staying with a sister in Hayward, California, probably from about 1990 on for a number of years, and she was the right-hand person for Woody Farmer's promotion, which predated Roland's APW and also, you know,
Bay Area Wrestling.
Yeah, Bay Area Wrestling. They had a deal with Comcast local, so it was almost cable access-like, but it was big-time TV, and Mae Young was the first to break in Mike Lockwood, WWE.
I think it was even before Comcast existed.
Yeah, it was United Artists Cable. Yeah, it was United Artists TCI. It was TCI Cable because it went through a number of buyouts and name changes before Comcast purchased it.
Correct.
That was our studio in Hayward, right off Winton, by where APW was in the business park, the APW Garage Dojo. And Mae Young would like run production for Woody. She trained folks. And, you know,
Jericho was on a number of those shows.
Who was?
Chris Jericho.
I was there. Now, he was just one day on a Saturday for a series of three tapings. And Woody's mistress at the time, Kathy Kearney, came in the back and she had no idea this guy was already a superstar then. I had already shot him in FMW Japan, or not FMW, but the promotion Universal, where he was working with Ultimo Dragon, Yoshihiro Asai. He was already, and I think then that's when they took it to FMW, and then they did stuff in New Japan, but also in Mexico City for the UWA promotion, which brought in the foreigners, you know, like Vader, Terry Funk, Owen Hart, obviously Chris Benoit's Pegasus Kid, and Owen. And so, you know, it's just, so anyway, so Kathy Kearney was like schooling and telling him that he was the shits or something, and like, who do you think you are, blah, blah, blah. And I just let her have it. And like, Chris was too polite to say anything. And, you know, this was like 91, late 91, early 92. And like, this person, like, she thought she was running the locker room. You know, that's the problem that we had with Jerry Monty's gal, and also who owned the ring. And I guess that's the ring now that, well, that's in Big Time Wrestling. But Alexa Smirnoff, he had a girlfriend that was like running his shows. And the trouble was, a lot of us, not just me, but many others bigger than me, would say to Woody Farmer, Jerry Monty, who was a longtime Roy Shire jobber throughout the whole 70s until Roy closed up shop, Alexis Smirnoff, who my Dubois, who started in Montreal for the Vachon's promotion in the 70s, early 70s, that they wouldn't just join forces collectively, you know, instead of like drawing 50 to 300 people, depending on the show, join forces, and then they would have a much bigger, you know, audience, make more money, but, you know, they didn't want to do that. And,
that's been one of the problems of the Bay Area is that we've had a number of different feds here, and no one particular fed, not since the early days of Shire, you know, has unified all these independent feds and made them and showcased all the talents that they had at once. There's always been some kind of regional beef and individualism set up from one fed or another, whether it's because of personalities, whether it's because of territorialness, whether it's because of greed. I mean, BTW and APW were always two separate entities, and they were never
going. Well, they had those two attempts. They were very brief. Now, Roland was a student of the business, and he loved it growing up. He wasn't so much about the money. In fact, I don't
know. He never made money. Well, he wanted money.
So it wasn't about the money, but he created the history. I mean, the King of the Indies led to Ring of Honor, which changed the whole business. And you have to have respect for that. And even though he came off as a heel and beyond the mat, all of those things, but they tried twice, but Kirk White was just about, you know, I'll say it, he was greedy at times and just about the money. And when they tried doing an interpromotional twice, APW versus BTW, he'd come in with Jason Styles to the booking meeting and he'd say, you know, just have us do our thing on the mic first so I can get out of here. We want to go to an A's game or Ricky's Sports Bar in Hayward nearby, you know, where APW was in that business park off Winton. And it was like disrespectful. Then they would leave. Whereas like Roland, if he went to BTW shows, he would stay for the whole thing, take notes, be a real student the way a promoter should be. Kirk just didn't care. I mean,
let's be honest. 95% of the BTW talent was totally untrained. They were as barely trained as you could be and get into a wrestling ring. They were this far from being backyard talent. Most of the undercard that BTW put together, if they weren't borrowing APW guys, were terrible.
They did. There were often our refs, you know, later on Sparky Ballard, but before that Max Marquez would be asked in, you know, because they just really didn't have much in the way of refs. They had Ronnie Washington, who had a brief stint with WWE as a ref. He was fine. But their talent, you know, I can really only think of one who had super duper potential. I could be wrong on this, so maybe our listeners can say, you know, hey, you're wrong on this. But Bailey, who was wrestling, and she had told me that name, Davina Rose, was the two first names of her two grandmas, and she created that as her wrestling name. You know, I've heard that she's changed that story a little bit, but that's what she told me in the back. And she really showed promise. And the guy in the Good Brothers, what's his name? The big tall guy. You know, this is what happens when you're approaching 70. What his name is now, you know, he was Festus. You know the guy I'm talking about. And then he became what he's doing now. And he's, you know, big deal in the original group, the Bullet Club in New Japan. I'll look him up in a sec. But his wife was a great lady wrestler and still is. And she, like me, was telling Bailey, her real name is Pam, you got to get out of here. You got to go to Shimmer Shine. You know, you have to get away. You're only going to get this far and you're not going to get much further. And that's what happened. She finally listened or whatever happened. She got to Shimmer and Shine and then got to go to WWE's developmental and became the huge star that she is now. And what was I going to say about that? She did get to wrestle. Kirk did pay and brought in Gail Kim and Candice LeRae and quite a few other talents. Cheerleader Melissa Anderson wrestled her a lot on BTW shows. So what your point was is absolutely correct. The APW talent had to come in often to save the shows other than the name fly-ins, because Kirk twice tried no fly-ins, no APW talent, just Jason Styles, I forget what his real name is, his trainees, and it just didn't draw.
It's terrible. So no, they were. I mean, I got four words for you: Dash Riprock and White Trash. Those two wrestlers were so bad.
I forget who White Trash was. The one guy though that was masked, the babyface who was masked, the high flyer, he was pretty good. He was there for a number of years. I think he got injured, but he came back when we had the what?
Flaco Loco?
No, no, no. It was somebody earlier. He had like a white mask.
Before I even got involved in wrestling.
He was very good. Jason always got the main event spot. So the name fly-in guys, the name talent.
Yeah, he would wrestle Mike, 5 minutes.
Chris Masters. Well, he always got to wrestle the name talent that was brought in there, like the WCW.
And he always jobbed to them. And he always jobbed to them. He was like the Washington General of the and they were all the Harlem Globetrotters that came in and flew in.
They drew the crowds. They helped sell that venue. That was a good venue. You have to admit it was in the
Newark Pavilion.
Yeah, the Newark Pavilion. It's just next door, just north of San Jose.
And then don't forget that Shane Cody was always super loyal to
he was loyal, but then he was not trained by Jason Styles. His dad trained him, Woody Farmer, and right. that third generation thing. He had the son
Shane
that
Shane was on every show. Shane was pretty much on every show. Shane Cody pretty much was on every BTW show. And
that was fine because he was there initially, because the thing is, I said this early on when I did this show, and you and Evan that started it for X period of time and then brought me aboard, was that Woody gave his cable access time slot to Kirk and BTW, and the ring, he couldn't have helped anybody more. And I think he later might regret it because, you know, Woody then started promoting his own shows in opposition to Kirk White, as did Icebox. Robert Smith, his real name, who was a the later part, the not original true Bay Bombers, but the later when it was, you know, restarted in the late 80s, 90s, he was part of that. So he would promote an opposition. So you had Woody Farmer's own promotion. You had Iceboxes. You had Kirk's BTW all competing against the first one, who, in my opinion, did it the best in APW. Because every time you went to those shows,
there's also Devil Mountain, and you had SBW doing shows here in the Bay Area.
That's not the only ones, because then there was the charity events at Great America that you mentioned. There were other things, but, you know, just to reel off four, and, you know, Roland was the one both times who offered to Kirk, let's do an interpromotional. He was trying to help Kirk out. And Gabe Ramirez, you know, he's got his Lucha thing. So a lot of things, and it would be nice gold. Now we have I think the number one promotion there is the one in South San Francisco. You know, APW, Marcus Jacobs and Marcus Mack have started promoting. But while they were closed, there was a lot of stuff, I guess, with the Athletic Commission that kind of hindered Marcus from bringing APW back once the pandemic hit. But that South San Francisco group bringing in Minoru Suzuki and all those AEW and New Japan guys, they just went right to the top. I mean, Debbie Malenko, who had been retired after speaking of Medusa, when she quit All Japan Women in 1990 and then sued the owner Matsunaga brothers, they brought in Debbie Malenko, who was a Malenko Jim trainee. Her real name was Debbie Killian, and when she was wrestling for Dean and Joe Malenko and their dad before he passed, Larry Simon, the great Malenko, Professor Boris Malenko's promotion there in Florida, she was known as Debbie Drake. But All Japan Women, when Medusa leaves, they bring her in. I was there for her debut, you know, that period of time when I was almost living in Japan in 1991. She debuted March 17th of 1991 on, not at Karakuen, but a spot show for All Japan Women. And she was in like second from the bottom tag match, where I think it was Saki Hasegawa broke her neck in the middle of the match, not working with Debbie Malenko. But All Japan Women tried bringing back a replacement Medusa Michelli in Debbie Malenko. That was the name, because she could hook and shoot, but she didn't last as long, and then she retired. But she came back on the South San Francisco group's show. Have you been, Russ, are you keeping up with all of what they're doing, or been to one of their shows, the South San Francisco?
No, I went, the very first wrestling show I'd been to in 5 years was the Full Queer Wrestling show that I went to about 3 weeks ago. That's the first one I've been to. So I'm slowly trying to get back to live events. Also, my kids are a little older, so I can, you know, not have to take them with me to the show. I can just go, you know, my wife used to make sure that I, you know, didn't leave the kids alone for a Saturday or a Saturday night. So I had no way to get out.
I get it. The parenting, so you gotta do it.
While we have a couple minutes left, I wanted to say that Mark Madison with Pro Wrestling Stories just published an article, helped do some contribution on. He didn't call you about it, but he did want to make a shout out to Pro Wrestling Stories. Check out the latest article on Gary Albright, who was one of my favorite wrestlers and probably, I think, the greatest quote-unquote unknown wrestler that's out there. you know.
Oh, Gary was a great friend of mine. He would call me, email me early on when he was in All Japan for Baba, well, Baba's group, and then also for the UWF, the Takata MMA. It was worked. It wasn't a shoot, but it was supposed to be MMA, even though it was a worked thing. And was best friends with Steve Williams. They were a tag team in All Japan.
Can you get a tougher tag team than Dr. Death, Steve Williams, and Gary Albright?
Well, both amateur greats, because Gary Albright came from Nebraska. And I miss him to this day. I dug up all of these photos for his widow, who it's either Offa or Sika's daughter. Somewhere in there. I might have it mixed. But, you know, that whole family, Sika's. The Anawahi family, mourns him. That guy was aces, and he was double tough, but he got a brief thing that he wanted to have success, not just in Japan, but in the U.S. So he was on at least one, maybe two ECW shows, which was his dream. He passed away in the ring on, I think it was Offa's show in the, it was, somewhere in the Northeast, and passed away on that show. But, just a wonderful.
He didn't have that body that Vince wanted. You know, he didn't have the chiseled, Dave Bautista type look that I think Vince really wanted to have. He was that old school kind of Terry Gordy or Dr. Death Steve Williams. You know, Dr. Death Steve Williams wasn't a chiseled, Adonis. Type guy.
Well, he was ripped in comparison to Gary. Gary loved to eat and he loved to drink, but he could put on the athletics like nobody's business.
And the strength, the raw strength inside of Gary Albright. I personally have never seen somebody suplex somebody as viciously, including Brock Lesnar, as Gary Albright did. Gary Albright knew how to really rock people from the top of their shoulders down to their toes with those German suplexes that he used to do and the rear suplexes that he used to pull off. And his scientific knowledge of holds and the ability,
He was a collegiate. He was like an All-American. He was a true, that's what I respect. He came to one Cauliflower Alley and sat with me, and I dragged him to pose for photos with John Tolis, Lou Thez, Danny Hodge, a number of guys, Don Curtis, who I keep in touch with his widow, Dottie, who I'd like to bring on the show. She has a memory to match mine, and she's in her 80s, and she helped him run at least two offices for Eddie Graham. And she was one of the big talking heads on that dark side of the ring on all the suicides, the six total during three generations of Eddie Graham's family, including his son, Mike Graham. Which is pretty horrible. I mean, 2 months before Mike Graham died, he was at the 2012, the very last of the three in a year WrestleCons there. And he was in the big opening battle royal, which Roland loved. But this was down in Los Angeles at the Westin Hotel. And, I have a ton of photos. He did a panel with Chris Daniels and super, super duper guy, especially after his dad Eddie passed. But I think Gary did some stuff with Mike Graham when Mike Graham was trying to keep the promotion going when Eddie died in, was it 85? And it really took us all by shock. And the promotion, had a hard time making it and finally sold to Crockett before Crockett also bought out Bill Watts, UWF, and then had to sell to Turner in just a short span of time. But look up, as Russ is saying, look up online. Let's look up, and we want to pay tribute to Darren Drozdov, Puke. Look up some of his matches to honor him. Look up Gary Albright and his matches to honor Gary. We've lost both of these guys. It's hard to believe. But at that CAC, Gary was like a kid in a candy shop, getting to meet these guys and have his photo taken with a number of them, like Dick Hutton, who was an NWA champion that Lou Thez handpicked, I think whatever the year was, like 58, for Thez to drop the title to. Lou would handpick his guys, similar to Bruno handpicking Ivan Koloff and telling Vince Sr., this is who I want to drop the strap to. But yeah, you're right. Where, Russ, where did you see Gary? Were you watching footage of him, or where did you get to see
him? Oh, yeah, I followed him from his collegiate days in through. He was the guy that when I saw him wrestle in college, I was like, this guy could be an amazing pro. You know, I could see the talent that was there. And again, he just wasn't a hit here in the United States. You know, the United States just really...
He didn't get any opportunities.
No.
Nobody hired,
The kind of wrestling he did was not the kind of wrestling that Vince McMahon really was interested in showcasing. And he didn't get the break that he... And at the same time, the WCW and ECW were so into the garbage type stuff. They were really at that point, you know, when he was at his height, they were doing, you know, hitting people with trash can lids and...
WCW had... other things going on. One thing I should say, one of his other best friends, we can actually spend some time talking about Gary, because another best friend besides Doc was Max Payne, Man Mountain Rock, who, if we don't bring Alan Bolte was scheduled tonight, but he had a family crisis happen. You know, a bunch of people came from out of state descending on him out of the blue. But if Alan Bolte can't come back on next week to go through all of the programs he produced as editor for the Roy Scheider Territory, I'll have Max Payne on. And Max was so close, toured and teamed with Gary Albright for when he wasn't teaming with Doc in All Japan. But he also went with him and Vader, Leon White, to, again, that UWF, that work shoot group. So he will be able to talk our socks off. We'll just let him rattle off because he could go for a good hour on Gary Albright.
And I love the UWF. That was my favorite. Wrestling.
Federal. But it was work. The super group, before I do, I have to leave. I don't know if you're going to be able to, you could carry on very well.
No, I'm going to sign off. Like,
well, it is July 4th on a Sunday when we're taping this, but the original UWF that Takata came from was a super mega group for MMA by a bunch of disgruntled New Japan guys led by the original and best Tiger Mask, Satoru Sayama, along with Sammy Sorinaka. And they had their shows at the big Tokyo Egg Dome before any wrestling came there. I was there at ringside. You'll see me right at ringside for Flair Fujinami, March 21st, 1991, at the Tokyo Dome, the NWA versus New Japan big show with Steiner five-star match, tag match with Hase Sasaki and Sting against Muda, etc. But my point was... We'll have a lot of fun with Max Justice, who's got a new YouTube channel, but he can really talk about being on the road with Gary Albright and Steve Williams, too. But so that super group, that was my point. The guys that were in it all broke off. Takata formed UWFI, which was the group you're talking about that had Gary Albright and Steve Williams, etc., looking like they were, that was the only one of the four groups that broke up from the Sayama UWF group that was not a shoot. Takata had the UWF, but Maeda had rings. Pancrase was run by Masakatsu Funaki, and Fujiwara, who the Fujiwara armbar was named after, and other holds, submission holds, was another one of the three out of four.
I know Abrams had his own.
No, this was unrelated. Herb Abrams just took the name for the showbiz, WWF castoffs as UWF, but no, this was MMA UWF. This was Japan UWF. Had nothing to do with that. Or Bill Watts UWF, which is what Mid-South became, the touring late 80s. And luckily, I shot all of their TV taping west of Oklahoma. You know, they came into L.A. and San Jose and had some magnificent shows. Russ, I have to go. But
all right.
I want to say, as you do too, that our love, prayers, and respect for Darren Drozdov's family, and the show's dedicated to him, but also the memory of Gary Albright, a friend of ours. And we're going to learn a lot from Mac Justice when we have him on about Gary Albright.
Looking forward to it. All right. Well, you have a safe holiday, and we'll catch you again next week. So everyone, next week, sorry for the short show, but sometimes you get what you can get, you know. You get double your money back.
Good and short. This was mainly a tribute to Darren Drozdov. Terrific guy, beloved in the wrestling business, particularly WWE. And domonogatou gozaimashite, to everybody. So we're talking Japan. Good night, everybody.
All right. Good night, everyone. See you next week.